history of personal computing. History of Personal Computing.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. I'm David, and both Jeff and I are here with a new episode of the History of Personal Computing eBay Edition podcast. We're going to take an informal look at personal computing history through the lens of eBay auctions. It's a little like the Antiques Roadshow program, but all about antique personal computers and in your ears. Hey there, Jeff.
Good morning.
Yeah, we're recording on Sunday morning. Not too early, but early enough, right?
I still don't have my makeup on yet.
Yeah, and I've only just now started sipping my coffee. But we're sorry for the late program, but I had to be out of town for a sick relative who was doing okay. But I didn't get into...
That's good to hear. They're doing much better.
So I didn't get into late last night, like after 11, after, you know, 7.5 hours, 8 hours of driving. So a little bit groggy. You hear it in my throat, I think, right?
A little bit. It sounds like you've been awake a long time and talking and talking.
And I hate driving at night. I really try to avoid that because obviously it's, you have to keep yourself awake, but it's just, I don't like it.
I don't know. Staring contests with the billboards and losing.
Yeah. Oh, and then coming into Atlanta on a Saturday night, coming home, it's just awful. But moving right along, we are here. We're back, and we're back for a new edition of the show. And we have a couple of news items or items of interest to talk about. So, Jeff, go ahead. What do you got?
Okay. This is just something that when I read it, just kind of, I don't know, tickled a little something. You know, you and I, David, we are really into vintage computing and stuff. And, you know, we do what we can to teach the general public or, give the general public something to listen to and, you know, we discuss vintage computing, but it's seeing it, or maybe not our efforts, but seeing the efforts of a collective of vintage
regular people.
Regular people, yeah. Convincing regular people or showing regular people that, hey, there's some cool stuff out there still, you know, if you just look back a few decades. And so I came across this article on the Register. And it's just somebody talking about how their Tandy 102, which is just like a slightly enhanced version of the Tandy 100 portable computer. I have the 100. Don't have the 102. Don't know what the difference is exactly. I just know there were some minor changes to it.
I don't remember either. Yeah, there's some minor changes.
Whatever happened to the 101?
It's later, you know, so it came out afterward. But there's some. I know it's minor stuff, but there's something enhanced about it. And also, as we know, what happens with some of this stuff, it could have also been cost reduced too. So
that could be.
Yeah, they redesigned it because then they made more profit off of it.
Oh, actually, the article does touch a little bit on what the 102. Well, do they?
Oh yeah. Well, it says the 102
was thinner and lighter than its predecessor and offered 24K as its
memory.
So yeah, it had more memory and yeah, probably cost reduced. That's typically how this stuff works. But it's just, you know, somebody. Talking about how their 30-year-old vintage laptop computer is still running for them. And, you know, they're getting that feeling that this is still a cool machine. So, you know, it's kind of like a human interest story for vintage computer collectors. And it just kind of tickled me. So that's why I thought I'd put it in.
Oh, and by the way, and so this was just released on the 17th, just a few days ago, by Darren Pauly. And, you know, and for our American listeners, the Register is a UK, I want to say, did it used to be a newspaper? But it's just a website.
I don't know offhand.
But it's based out of UK.
But their motto is biting the hand that feeds IT. So it's a geek rag, whatever it is.
With a vulture. But if you look at the bottom of that article, so link in the show notes, go there, and there's 40 comments. I've been meaning, once I saw you posted this, I want to see what people are saying. But it says, if you're something older or odder, if you've something older or odder than Ed's Tandy 102, let me know with a link there. And you may appear in a future edition of Runtime, or use that link to suggest a better name for this column. So there you go. Let's all write in, and we can all appear there.
All right.
Our old computers and such.
That sounds, well, gee, an Atari 400 is older. But it's not Otter. It's not Otter. What would be Otter? The Chromemco?
Yeah, I think so.
That would work.
All right.
But well, anyway, like I said, it just kind of took me. So, yeah, now this is more of the general public, you know, getting into this. Like, I remember this, and I kind of like this, and hey, and I still have one. It works. Yay.
Well, we need to go back to that guy's column and kind of watch it now. See what else might show up there. Other people have to respond. So I added something. This is something you brought to my attention, Jeff. And in the Facebook group, what is it called? Retro Computing Repair Forum. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I think I touched on that once.
And so this is a link to the creator's webpage. And it's about the Pi. So, you know, capital P, little I for Raspberry Pi. The Pi DP. -8/i, recreating the PDP-8i. And I think you posted in the Facebook group, it's like retro computing.
Yes, that's right.
Repair group.
Now looking at this page, yeah, I did respond to that in Facebook.
And about, you saw one of these at VCF East last year, I guess?
It was really nice.
And you thought about buying one?
But yeah, the price is just a little bit out of hand for me.
Yeah, I think is it $169, $159 unassembled?
Yeah.
Somewhere there. But it's really cool looking. I mean, so basically it looks like a PDP-8 front panel that's in a nice little like frame. Like a wooden frame.
Yeah, it's got some wonderful looking. I don't know if it included the frame or if it just gave you the panel and then you can, you know, make the frame, but you know, the way they source the switches and stuff like that, that's all. It's all really nice stuff.
Yeah.
It looks great.
And so I thought that was pretty cool. I really like that. And having an Altair replica, I just think this would be pretty neat. And I would actually like to get one, even though I don't know a lot about PDPs and it's, you know, but anyway, I want to touch on that because I thought it was pretty neat. And I went to the site. So check that out.
Good stuff. The kind of the revivalism of older systems and then modernized like that PDP-8. And then I ended up picking up that Kim Uno instead when I was there, which is a Kim computer based on an Arduino Uno. Mm-hmm. So it's had a back-end computing device, a microprocessor device to drive the functionality that recreates the original functionality.
And it does come with there's one of the links at the page is building the kit with lots of good pictures and parts lists and everything. And so that frame comes with it. So it actually, the whole thing mounts inside the frame. So,
oh, it does. Okay.
Yeah. So when you're done, it looks like the picture that is.
And this is a 2016 version. So what I saw was the 2015 version.
That didn't have the frame and stuff. Maybe.
I don't know. If it came with a frame, that's great.
But this kind of stuff is amazing. We're going to see more. I think we're going to see more and more of this sort of thing too, going forward.
Oh, absolutely. I like to see miniaturized vintage PCs that actually work, like a miniature, maybe a Raspberry Pi driven or that new Pi Zero, which is even smaller, driven, say, Atari 400 or 800 with just, you know, a miniature size with miniature keys at work.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, that sounds like a project.
So moving along then. And I'm kind of out of it. If you can't tell. I'm not like woken up, but we're going to keep going. So on today's show, we are continuing our coverage of the 32-bit GUI computers. We've covered some exciting and colorful 32-bit computing platforms, but in this episode, we go a little more boring and a little more beige by covering the Compact Desk Pro 386 and then other 386-based computers, and also touching on the Windows 386 operating system. So from our friend Wikipedia, I'm going to read a couple of just nuggets out of there, and they'll be linked in the show notes to these two articles in this case. So Windows 2.1X was marketed as Windows/286 and Windows/386. So actually that one version was broken down into two versions. And they were both released on May 27th, 1988, less than 6 months after release of Windows 2.0. These versions could take advantage of the specific features of the Intel 286 and Intel 386 processors. A hard disk was required for the first time to install Windows. And both versions could take advantage of the high memory area, or HMA, and the 386 version introduced protected mode. And I think, of course, there's more information there in the article. I think protected mode was important because it was also in the higher memory range, and the Windows ran in that portion.
Well, protected mode also introduced what's more common now in Intel processors, at least ring level security. the CPU actually breaks down into separate privilege rings, with ring zero being the most privilege on the system, and ring three being the least. So there's four different rings.
And
the operating system.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. No, you finish.
Right. The operating system ran in ring zero, so it had full control of everything. Operating system kernel, whereas applications ran on ring three, and anything running as an application in ring three could not touch what the operating system had control of. Now, of course, hackers and everything that work, people find ways around that, but that was the original intent, to keep the operating system safe from other things. And drivers would operate at lower rings, like two and one, that would have a little more privilege on the system, but still the user's application was not supposed to, or not able to, touch any of the more privileged features of the system.
Well, and also I think the key is there, because you used the word security, which is true, but also I think stability was they were going for too, right? That's when you first were able to like kill an application and not bring the whole system down.
Exactly. It helps do that too.
That sort of thing. So the second part of this is from another Wikipedia entry. And it says, the Intel 8386 was a 32-bit microprocessor introduced in 1985. I think I read, too, where it really didn't start getting produced in numbers to like the following year. The first versions had 275,000 transistors and were the CPU of many workstations and high-end personal computers of the time. The first personal computer to make use of the 8386 was designed and manufactured by Compaq and marked the first time a fundamental component in the IBM PC compatible de facto standard was updated by a company other than IBM.
Go Compaq.
Yeah. So really this sort of marked so I think the 386 introduced a lot of things. It sort of introduced, it introduced like true 32-bit computing for PCs. You know, IBM compatibles are called back then, as well as really made the idea of a graphical user interface sort of real and practical for the first time.
A business environment or business computing environment. Yeah.
Even though Windows really wouldn't be adopted in any type of like impressive numbers to the next version, Windows 3 and then Windows 3.1. But where was it going here? Oh, and then the...
I know, it's Sunday morning.
Let me sip some more coffee. Anyway, I don't know. You got any more comments about that?
No, it's just for me, I remember sort of when 386s and what IBM PCs themselves. I really wasn't into the IBM compatibles and PCs until like early 1990, actually. A lot of that early stuff just went right by me because I was still Commodore and Amiga. But I do remember seeing more and more of these different computers showing up in computer stores that had all the same functionality, but they were made by different companies. So it wasn't IBM anymore. It was companies like Compaq and what are some of the other early ones? I think we even talked about that. Amstrad did something similar. And I think Commodore got into it a little bit later with their PC clones and stuff. But yeah, the 386, yeah, I kept getting wind of this. Yes, we can do multitasking on our computers now. And I'm sitting here, you know, four or five years with Amiga, you know, kind of laughing and giggling in all these computer shows. That's where I remember seeing all these like Market Pro shows in this area. Or there was another big one that went around. You would see people buying these motherboards with 386s. They can run, you know, this graphic operating system. And can do multitasking to some degree. But it actually kind of blew up before I started taking notice.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, obviously what I'm about to say, I don't completely agree, but this was the public mindset or attitude. It's like, you know, it didn't matter until these things happened, until sort of 386 was introduced, and then ultimately Windows 3 as far as graphical user interfaces and all that started happening. Because DOS ruled the world, pretty much, the large majority. All of us who didn't use a PC or IBM compatible, you know, we were in the minority. you know, by the late 80s. I was just looking up too because I wasn't totally sure, but so the, you know, the 286 was a 16-bit processor, and obviously it had big improvements over the earlier 8086. So one thing that's interesting about the 386 is that at the time you had the full-on 386, which was obviously very expensive, and like the early Dust Pro used it. Oh, and there's an article here too that's in the show notes. Excuse me, and it's a New York Times article from 1988. Let me just click that up real quick. And it's the executive computer. A top machine carries a top price. And it talks about the Compaq Dust Pro 386-20, which was between $7,500 and $12,500 without a monitor.
Amazing.
which is insane. But that's early 1988, January 1988 prices. So what I was talking about, that was a true 32-bit, what became known as the 386-DX. But for most consumers, well into the early 90s too, when they were adopting 386 machines, is they came out with something called the SX. And do you remember the thing about that?
Yeah, I thought the SX got rid of the math coprocessor.
No, so that was a 486.
That was a 486.
So essentially, and this might be a big oversimplification of what it really was, but essentially what they did is they took the 386, which is a 32-bit processor that and it has a 32-bit internal bus and can sit on a 32-bit bus, which is what the DX did. So, and they stuck it on a 286 motherboard, which is a 16-bit bus. So crippling it, if you will, to a certain extent, but it's still way faster. A 386SX, you know, with a 16-bit external bus was still a lot faster than a 286. But most of your consumer grade 386s, that's what they were. Yeah. Later on the 486, they used that same.
That's right. It was the 486 that had it.
Nomenclature, yeah. Which was
either the SX was manufactured without a math coprocessor, or the math coprocessor portion failed.
Yeah,
so they disabled it in hardware.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. Maybe we'll talk about that more. But there you go.
All right.
So it's kind of interesting. I know. I wasn't a PC user back then either.
I did have one PC. One time in the late 80s, but it was an NXT laptop. It was a Toshiba T1000. I had it for like 6 months. I bought it because I was going to school, and then I realized that, oh, this is boring, and I ended up selling it for less than half of what I paid for it. So I had a lesson there in obsolescence.
But I know, I have some old computer shoppers, you know, from like 91, 92, you know, 93, 94, even I think 95 might be the newest one I have. But, you know, even in the early 90s, like I'll just say 92, 93, there were still plenty of people buying 286s. So unscientific here, but I think most consumers anyway, they were still buying a lot of 286s well into the early 90s.
They were cheap.
Yeah, because they became dirt cheap.
They ran DOS.
And pretty much you could do the stuff that you cared about as a average consumer, getting a decent price, I guess, to play games and, you know, run Windows, or if you wanted to do that, or certainly DOS. Yeah, I don't think most consumers ran Windows.
Dad's first computer, which was a Packard Bell, if that was a 286 or not. I think it was, actually. And I remember trying to run Wing Commander on it.
Oh, yeah?
And it must have been a 286 because the animated video, you could see the screens draw like they were coming down like window shades. But it ran it. and I just went back to my Amiga and played video games the right way.
Yeah, and of course, well into like even, well, certainly in the Windows 3, 3.1, like pre-Windows 95 for the most part. Even during Windows 95, most of your games, they ran in DOS. That you got out of Windows completely to play your games because it was just a lot of extra overhead.
Or would it be written just well enough to switch out into DOS instead of exiting Windows to play it?
Yeah.
Sort of like do that in turning Windows it 95. Off. There's still that DOS layer. They just, Microsoft kept trying to hide it in each revision of the operating system. Until now, we got to run DOSBox, right? These days, get the same feeling.
Now we miss it.
Yeah, let me go wipe a tear.
So what did you find on eBay for this show?
Let's see. Well, I thought I'd look into the software portion first. My first item is a copy of Microsoft Windows 386, and somebody got it brand new, shrink-wrapped in the box for $36 from Norway on 2 bids, so there's a bidding war on this. It would have cost $50 to ship it to me. And $36 doesn't seem like a lot, but when I was at VCF Midwest, and I had my son with me too, somebody was giving away, just talking about box Microsoft software, somebody was giving away, was it Visual Studio 6? There was like a box full of sealed boxes of Visual Studio 6. And my son grabbed one. I thought, oh, isn't that quaint? He wants to learn how to program. But in hindsight, I should have grabbed at least one or two boxes myself.
You could have sold them.
He turned around and sold it on eBay for $200.
Yeah. And, you know, people are generous at the festivals. Yeah.
They are. And, you know, and that's great. But it just shows that it wouldn't surprise me if this Windows 386 sold for a lot more than $36. I think what killed it here, if it might be the market. I don't know how eBay in Norway is. I don't even know who bought this and where they were. But there wasn't very many copies of Microsoft Windows 386 available on eBay when I looked this up. In fact, this is the only one I found, I believe, that was shrink-wrapped and then had an actual price. You know, it was already over. But still, I bet it could have gone for a bit more if it was sold in the U.S. Because there's people out there who are trying to recreate those old systems, even if they are Intel, you know, DOS Windows-based systems. You know, this would be perfect for museum-type collection.
Right, right.
Yeah. Shrink wrap. Shrink wrap's nothing for stuff like this. Just having everything complete is probably even
better.
And working. I think shrink wrap adds 5% to the price, in my opinion.
Yeah, unless you want to display it like that. Like maybe you want to recreate a late 80s computer store.
Somewhere in my disk, I have Windows 2.0.
Which that would be neat, wouldn't it?
I don't know if they're good or if they were rewritten with something else. You know, how people would just, because disks were expensive for the longest time and somebody gives away this, that, or the other, how we'll just reformat it and put our own stuff on it. I didn't get to that yet. I'm still going with my SuperCard Pro and going through all my floppy disks and just archiving. I've been doing that all this week. And I came across some of my boxes of disks, and I saw one of them had Windows 2.0. I didn't go through those disks yet and back them up to look any closer at them, but I should do that. That ought to be interesting.
And, you know, Jeff, I haven't looked at all, but I would imagine with a good search of the internet that probably all the different versions of Windows are out there as disk images.
They probably somewhere. Are.
Yeah.
As long as you can remember how to use it. Was it type win at DOS, and there you go. Anyway.
So you found a couple of compact laptops.
Yes. Let's see. And since these are all completed auctions, I got to scroll down even further. Here, compact SLT 38620, and that's the CPU and speed that we were talking about earlier in this episode, but this is a laptop version of it, so to speak.
I was going to say, this is a really interesting machine, and I've seen these over the years, and it's really interesting. Technically, I don't know if it's really a laptop. It's a portable.
Yeah.
I guess it's not really a laptop, though.
And this one is actually Moscow, Pennsylvania. Where is that? It would have cost $25 to ship it to me. The winning bid was $45, so I guess it's not
$49 to me.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So, and that's that says expedited shipping. Standard shipping would have been $2 less for me. But this, hang on, I scrolled too far now. There we go. But yeah, this is kind of neat that Compaq wanted portability. I think they were the first ones to really start showing portability can be affordable. Mm-hmm. I know IBM was it the 5150? Which one was it that was the portable IBM? I forget.
Oh, I think it was the 5155.
5155, that's right.
There's the top of my head.
5150, 5160, 5155. Oh, it's alphabet soup. Anyway.
Yeah, 5155. Yeah,
this is pretty neat, but Compaq, I think this started a trend of Compaq making a lot of portable, luggable, or even laptop computers. So they were trendsetters in this. But the style of this one is pretty interesting, how the keyboard sandwiches between the screen and the rest of the PC, I guess the box itself. Mm-hmm. And this one runs. It comes up right away to disk error. see, disk error, RTC lost power, so real-time clock, battery, internal battery's probably bad on this one. Mm-hmm. System options not set, insert diagnostic diskette. So who knows what's wrong with the hard drive. If it's an FMM or MFM hard drive, it's probably frozen. Spindle's probably not turning up. But yeah, it's a 38620 in a portable case.
And actually, in my opinion, I think what this represents for them in design is this is probably near the end of Compaq's line of what you'd call luggable portable type machines. Because by this point in the late 80s, then they started with, like most manufacturers went straight to just actual laptops, which are more about lightness and portability. Yeah. So what this replaced, though, which is a really unique design, is the earlier lunchbox style. Which would be sort of like a sewing, portable looking sewing machine or big lunchbox, and then you know what I'm talking about, where it had the plasma displays and all that.
I remember seeing
which were pretty neat. But I think what they were doing with this, obviously, is this was a serious portable computer. So this was about performance, not just portability. It was giving you a portable, sort of like serious computer, real computer.
The executive could take it home with him and put it on a, like the dining room table, power it up, and continue to work.
Because it really wouldn't be until the, early to mid-90s that laptops, even most, mid-grade ones, tried to really be like a full-fledged computer, replacement.
Yeah, and I actually moved on to the next auction, but I'm trying to remember if, did the back of that have a slot for expansion? Could you put things like a network card in it?
Probably not back then.
Okay, or at least maybe a modem of some sort will be on it.
Yeah, that I would think so.
300 baud, most likely, without going into details. But yeah, that's not what we do in the show. We look at some of the interesting picks and some configurations and their value.
But no,
go ahead.
I was just looking through when I was looking for auctions and a lot of portable stuff, there's a lot out there. If you just do searches for 386s especially, and then Compaq and stuff. Now, a lot of them don't work or have other problem stuff, but it looks like you can pick up a lot of these fairly cheap. So if you just look really hard, you can find one. Here's one like yours that looks like it works for, starting bid $35. Oh, look, here's another one in Moscow, Pennsylvania. Same person. Somebody active auction.
Cleared out a warehouse.
Yeah.
Let me go back to that one.
Does this one have a disk error too? Disk error? Oh, it says non-system disk or disk error. Yeah, so it might be same problem.
Could be somebody, formatted the hard drive because it had sensitive data on it.
Oh, here's some of the lunchbox styles I'm looking at, if you go to look at other people. Which that was a continuation of Compaq's very first computer, which was like a big luggable, and the bottom of it detached and was a keyboard.
Oh, I know why this one has an error. You're talking about the $35 one?
Uh-huh.
Because it looks like it's missing the hard drive.
Yeah,
probably. A big hole in the center of it.
Who needs it?
Exactly. Well, hey, that might even answer my question. Is this... did they have IDE hard drives back then? I don't know.
I don't think so. I don't think that came into the 90s.
So I was working on... IBM compatibles that had MFM hard drives in the early 90s. That's when I actually started making money working on them, working for a company that did field service repair. And that's really the first time I was thrown into, heavy into a IBM compatible world. And we were still running MFM drives on a lot of them, just getting into IDE, but a lot of them were still MFM drives. So we had the dual cable had to deal with, and the Seagate drives that had the external stepper motor that would freeze from time to time. You reach in and you give it a twist and it's fine again.
And those MFMs were rugged as all get out.
Well,
I think
that, my fingers.
I don't think IDEs were as...
the one in my K-Pro and the one in my TRS-80 Model 4...
Still work?
Is still work. And remember when I was talking about that MFM emulator? Mm-hmm. Or that hardware device? Guy got back to me. He's interested in coming up with a new run of the boards.
Cool.
So hopefully he'll say yes. I think he's just feeling for anybody who might want to get some so he can get a good cost for him. But hopefully he'll follow through with that. That'll be great. Then I'll get a board or two. and try to get these MFM drives backed up.
Well, as more and more people start appreciating the older, you know, IBM compatibles, any of them, you know, that's going to be a much bigger demand for those things.
Oh, and that's right. My 5150, that's the original desktop PC, IBM PC. I have the 5150 or 60, one of those two. That has an MFM hard drive in it. And I got to dig that out, make sure that still works.
So I just think even all the generic clones are, you know, more interesting these days now, because they're not like they used to be. They were everywhere before.
And even then, we could still say with the old ones, what were they thinking?
Yeah. Especially some of the weird ones that tried to differentiate themselves in some weird way.
Well, that's a good segue to my next auction.
Okay.
You were talking about how it's meant for power, and this can kind of go into the what were they thinking category. This one is, well, it's called the Amazingly Rare Compact SLT 286-386-20 Laptop Collection Enron Motorola Windows. Okay.
Oh, those really thick, giant ones.
Well, it's those SLTs, but it looks like the SLTs themselves go into a bigger docking station.
Yeah, that's crazy.
What were they thinking?
Wow.
Power, more power. So I guess this is kind of like in the lines of those Apple MacBooks that used to go into those docking stations in their entirety.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, IBM had their ThinkPad system. Their ThinkPads went on top of large base units, which provided expansion capabilities. It basically turned your laptop into a full-fledged desktop with expansion slots and additional storage.
Well, see, that's the thing. It's easy to sort of make fun of it now, but actually look at the design of it. Is basically, this literally gave you the best of both worlds, where when you're in your office and you're docked, that you really had like a full functional, powerful desktop computer, you know, with expansion and connectivity and everything.
And you didn't have to pull out the keyboard. You had your desktop keyboard then.
No, it looks like it's using the same keyboard.
I think he's demonstrating it that way, but I'm wondering if I can't see any facts of those other ones, but I'm wondering if those docking stations were to give you a desktop-based keyboard that stays there, and then when you go with it, you just open up the luggable and then use its keyboard when you're on the go. It's hard to say.
And
I mean, there's got to be a reason for that, Doc.
It was going for $1,250, which then it's crossed out and says best offer accepted. I wish eBay, why won't they show with how much the best offer accepted was?
Yeah,
they show other, when anything else sells. I don't understand why that's not displayed, but I wonder how much the person got for it.
$154 for shipping for me. You're a little closer to Raleigh, North Carolina. What was it for you?
Oh, shipping? $158.
It was more for you.
That's what it says. Yeah.
I have $153.72 from Raleigh. Maybe I am closer to Raleigh than you are.
You see how big it's got some good pictures in here. It's got like the battery charger things.
Oh, yeah, for the
where you pull the batteries out and you plug them into the charger.
But see, there is also an external keyboard up there, too. So,
it looks like it's got a tape backup drive, external.
Tape backup and 5 1/4 inch floppy, that compact 3/4 height. Half height. No, is it half height? This 3/4 half height. So I guess it's like 1/3 height or something like that. Compact did that too.
Those are pretty neat though. I like
them. Now the Enron part. What?
So where do they say they're from Enron?
Probably never before seen data. Okay. The 286 has some rare data on it.
Oh, yeah. I see it in Enron Corp. Wow.
There you go. Is the government still trying to sue Enron? Maybe that's who bought it.
They don't exist.
Yeah.
All right. So I guess this is...
There's a docking station. Okay, there are two slots in the back. He has more pictures down below than he does in that eBay scrolling picture thing that they always
put. Oh, yeah. Always scroll down.
Yeah.
So moving into
stuff. Yeah,
into mine, I chose let's go to the original.
Oh, yeah, that's my third one.
I chose a clone as my first item. So it says vintage DOS 6.2 gaming computer, CompuAdd 316S 3-inch and 5 1/4 inch floppy 386 restored. They got everything they could fit into the description there. But this was sold on the 3rd of February, and it was about from Texas. It was about $55 shipping to me, but... Excuse me, it sold for $119. This is a desktop 386, you know, again, generic. So this is a really good example of a later clone. CompuAdd was a pretty well-known. It was a more, I don't know if I would you call them premium. I think they were a pretty respected, clone maker.
You know, so they actually did make clones. They weren't like a major product line of a computer store brand.
I don't think. I mean, I'm only familiar with them from flipping through the computer shoppers. I mean, back in the day as well as now too. So it says it's from 1989. It's an S386SX16. So there you go. This was a consumer, not that businesses didn't use them. Machine. It's got DOS 6.2, 200 meg hard drive. I've installed. So this person has. Oh, that's the other thing too. Jeff, look at the pictures. Mm-hmm. And this person, he's got some good pictures of the motherboard inside. Is this the one? Oh, he put.
Oh, this has the vertical the 90 degree riser card.
Oh, so maybe it's another one then. But so this guy or this person put like AA batteries in, like a little.
Okay, I see. Yeah,
think better. But this computer has a total of 3 megs of RAM. That's odd. Expandable, which is great for running your old games. 200 watt power supply. That can be switched to 230 volt. Very desirable. Why? If it runs, what do I want to switch it out for? Sometimes that kills me when people with some old machines like, oh, I want to upgrade it and do this. And someone's like, why?
Can we switch to 230 volt?
If it functions the way it is.
And it's like saying, this brand new car has stylish steel wheels and wheel covers.
It's almost like taking this machine and say back in the day, it'd sure be nice if I had 4 megs of RAM, you know. But almost nowadays, why would you care as long as it runs the old stuff you want to run on it?
Yeah, if you're going to run DOS, you're not going to run more than about a meg anyway.
Well, there you go. So that's just a nice. So basically, and looking through different auctions, it looks like, you know, between, I think $100 is a good price point that you can find a very nice 386 desktop if you want to. You know,
yeah, if you want to play around and
good options and stuff.
The way things were. And that's a VGA card, external VGA card in there, I see. I was trying to figure out what that card was.
Probably upgraded, too, because I would think this machine originally had an EGA.
It's 256. I'm seeing two banks of four, 256. Are they kilobit on those? It probably had 256K of RAM on the card. So, yeah, it was standard VGA. Probably did up to, was it 1024 by 768?
Mm-hmm. 16 colors. So I am switching over to the next auction. This one is an AST, another well-known brand at the time, Premium Exec 386 SX20, fully loaded, SSD, extra RAM and keyboard, books, case. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Let me go back here. I know I was looking for... Yeah, so that the previous one, it sold. Okay. So in looking for other auctions, I think I was having a hard time, you know. And so this one's actually a live auction. This is a buy it now for $82.50. And it's got a really cheap shipping. So to me, it's only $17.26 out of Lake Worth, Florida. You can make an offer on it. The seller computer_preservation has 1,000 feedback, 99.8. So you might want to look at other stuff they have. But so this is a, sort of a bulky laptop. Let's see. Looks pretty good. Are you looking at it?
And it's a color screen too.
Yeah. So a really nice, it's got that really nice, easy, BIOS they had for a while.
And it has a SSD drive.
I saw that
of the time maybe. Oh, so replaced. Okay. Battery has been removed and replaced with a removable compact flash.
Yeah. What does that mean?
So I'm wondering if
they invest them in the hard drive.
It may have been an IDE drive, and they replaced it with one of those IDE to compact flash.
Yeah.
Which is cheap to do.
And they're saying the CMOS battery's dead and the floppy drive doesn't work, which that's kind of a worrisome thing because, you know, other than what's already on the hard drive,
what are you going to do? Every time you boot it up.
But the person put DOS 6.2, Wolfenstein 3D, and Windows 3.1. So,
well, yeah, which is the trifecta. That's what every business.
So really, what else do you need on it?
Yeah.
But, you know, again, you could probably pick this up. I bet you can get the person to come down a little bit. So you're buying it with shipping less than $100. Not too bad.
Yeah, shipping is $18.36 for me, so that's
not bad. You know, it's not like any of this stuff is going for a lot of money. especially these, but you know.
You know, I bet if somebody replied to this person and said, I'll pay you $80 shipped,
yeah,
they might get it.
Of course, a lot of this stuff is, you know, just not too long ago, is considered
junk.
And
the seller is, they call themselves computer preservation, and they're selling things at reasonable prices compared to other computer preservation sellers that
yeah. we
come across that sells things for like 3 times their value.
Right, right.
I won't name any names, but I'm sure we'll come across their auctions again.
So let's see. My last pick here is, let me click on it. So I did find a Compact Desk Pro 386, and I could not find one that had sold to kind of get a value.
I took it.
Oh, yeah. So this one is a live auction, vintage Compact Desk Pro 386, a real nice one, 8 megs of RAM, 60 meg HD, 3.5-inch floppy, 2535 desktop computer for $299.99. Buy it now or make an offer with free shipping out of New Jersey. I think $300 is too much.
Yeah.
But let's see. It's in pretty good shape.
This is the style I am familiar with.
Yeah. So real generic beige. But you know, this was the kick butt computer at the time, because this is a real DX. You know, this was like the top of the line machine. This is the one that costs $7,500 in that one article. You know, in 1988, wow. January 1988.
Yeah, we worked with these for a while at that. While I was telling you, I was working PC repair very early in my career. These Compact Desk Pros, they were good because they worked well, but mm-hmm. they were also a thorn in our side because we could not source third party. Add-ons or replacement parts. If you notice the drive bays here, there's one standard 5 1/4 inch half height drive bay, but the other two are a little smaller. So they were custom mm-hmm. made by Compact. You had to buy their drives as a replacement to make them fit in there. And well, they tried to work it as best they could so they'd have a revenue stream for anybody who wanted to upgrade to a second 3.5-inch floppy. Or well, they could put a full size 5 1/4 in, but if I also recall, they had custom drive rails too. You know, when you mount the drives, you couldn't use just a generic clone drive rail, those big plastic things that, you know, slid into the slots. They had something special. It was thinner and designed a different way, made out of metal, a little wider on the track. It was just really weird. It ended up, some of our customers were just kind of rolling their eyes at the prices we had to charge for the replacement parts.
Now, in just a discussion of value on this particular one and these in general, so in my opinion, you know, overall condition of this is just the box is not bad. You know, I'm sure you could clean it up a little bit more, but it's in pretty good shape overall. But without a keyboard and without anything else, and the fact that it does post, so, you know, it's not technically broken, but it's not booting or anything, then in my opinion, $300 is way too much for it. I mean, maybe yeah. $100 in this condition.
Unless you're a dust collector, then there's plenty of dust. Maybe it's the varieties of dust in this thing.
Well, you know, supply and demand, there aren't a lot of these out there. So, you know, I could be wrong.
I'm looking at this big wad of dust behind the 3.5-inch drive.
Oh, are you?
Yeah. It's like a big ball of dust.
Inside?
Yeah. And there's an overhead view
okay.
picture, and then you look down on it, and there's the big ball of dust.
I'm looking. Yeah. So, you know, and it's like the person... It seems like you start wanting to get $300 for something, you ought to at least take a little bit of time.
Clean it up.
Yeah. And you know, maybe you can say more about it All right.
The outside looks like it had some tape in spots, and you can see where the monitor was sitting. There's 4 dark spots. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Sat for a long time.
Yeah. We David and I both agree this $300 is way too much for this, but it's an interesting piece. To a collection if somebody wants to collect some of the earlier IBM compatibles or the clones. But I don't know. What do you think, David? $150 shipped would be a good price for this?
Yeah. Like I say, I think maybe $100 and then plus shipping might be reasonable for a machine that, you know, in that condition, just as is. And, you know, it has potential, but it's not booting.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know. And I think what we need on the show is a button. So when we make a decision like this, we can push it. And then that auction's immediately canceled.
Give us some authority.
So we're canceling the auction in a virtual way.
Yeah.
In a theoretical way. You're canceled.
Yeah, Just put in a buzz sound.
Oh, yeah. We need to add that to the show. All right. So we have a couple bonus auction picks.
Floppy drives down, right?
That we picked. And so you picked a Sharp pocket computer.
Yes. Hey.
Nice.
I guess I could have picked a Holly Hobby watch if I wanted to for this extra auction. I picked this one because
it's got a printer.
Open a search. eBay's actually getting better showing you things that you might be interested in after other auctions. So this came up in one of those, and I thought, hey, this is neat. I actually have stuff like this. The Pocket Computer PC 1270 is very similar in nature to the other Sharp and Radio Shack branded pocket computers that were out there. This will actually run basic software that's been written on other Sharp pocket computers of the time. But what makes this so special is this was designed to have master software written for it and stored onto a battery backed up RAM card that went into the back of this thing. So you can actually write it on another Sharp pocket computer, save it to that battery backed up RAM, put it in this thing. And it has a series of buttons on the front. As you see, it has a yes button, a no button, an enter button. And it has 8 function keys, and a piece of paper could be made that would slip in there to act as a function key template. It looks like somebody just used stickers, like they just printed up on a sticker strip or something and put it in there. But this is something that would be purchased by an industry that would need to have some portable, you know, data collection or management or calculation, like an insurance salesman, or I think this one.
This is like a draperies company, and they actually, this was probably used.
Yeah, they would probably use this. It was probably custom software written to run on this device, so they can go and maybe do measurements in a house, type it in, and then this thing will spit out numbers and results like, okay, we have 3 windows this size, you know, and then it'll say, well, we need this many yards of fabric, and this is how much it'll cost you. And then maybe the drapery person could be a salesperson, can then hook it up to the bigger printer cassette recorder thing. And print out, you know, this information, print out like a quote or something.
That's really neat. And this is a great example of like one of these devices where it was actually used for something really, efficiently used for something. Because, yeah, so the 8 buttons are draperies and valance, swags, cornice, special, soft shade, beds, tables, setup. And it's got a yes and no button, enter. Yeah, so this was set up for someone who probably didn't really know how to use one of these. In other words, it was set up for someone to be able to just use it, not have
to. Maybe somebody worked program from home, or a salesperson.
I bet you a smart business person. They probably had a few of these.
Yep,
and they got it down, mastered it, and then duplicated it across a few other of these devices. And in fact, it's got a printer too.
For insurance adjusters too, this same type of device could have pre-programmed software for, you know, insurance adjusting, and then you can print out, you know, the receipt. And this is all battery powered. That big recorder thing has its own internal batteries. I have one of those, and it's really nice. And then you can also save data to tape, just like you would with a full size computer with a tape player. You can save programs. If you put another Sharp device in here, you can actually write programs, save it to tape, however they wrote their software is one thing. But this was a very versatile, and it's small. I mean, it's about the size of a 10-inch tablet, just thicker.
Yeah, this went in somebody's briefcase or side bag, or they just carried it in, or whatever. Probably you're right. I'm certain probably to people's homes. Yeah, they came into someone's home and then they talked to them and showed them samples, materials and stuff, took measurements, and then processed this information. And then they probably had their own forms to write it down on, in the printouts.
Yep. Yeah, they can hand the customer a printout and say, here's the numbers we talked about.
Well, this is going to end in only 11 and a half hours. It's only up to $20 with $9.
Yeah, so if I want it, we're going to post this episode in 12 hours, right?
Yeah. Now, I think this is a great – someone can pick this up for a good deal and be a very interesting, unique little machine.
Yeah.
It'd be great if it still works. You won't
do much with that pocket computer or that PC 1270 because it's pre-programmed. That's the only problem.
I think that'd be great, though, if you could.
If you want to get into the business of selling, you know, drapes and swags, there you go. It's turnkey.
Yeah. All right. So what I chose, and I thought, oh, what do I want to look for? And I was looking for S100 computers. And so what I ended up doing is if you click on the link in the show notes, it's going to give you just a generic search term, S100, within Vintage Computing, under Vintage Computers and Mainframes, and these are all sold listings. They have completed listings in eBay, so these are ones that are actually sold.
Like those Pentium S100s.
Yeah, so, and a few things will come up that don't actually belong. But in just browsing, so 26 listings have come up as of this moment that have sold in here. So just going through here real quick, some of the S100 machines that have sold was an MSI 8080 for $1,125. A CompuPro S100 System 816 for $799. Couple of, you know, more MSIs. Another one for $2,699. One for $1,735. Another one for $859. What else I see here?
They still command some pricing.
There are all these. It's funny, all these MSIs. And a Sol 20, $1,198. And then another MSI for $998. So I'm not looking at what they have and the differences, but just to give you an idea. And then some boards. And by the way, if you do a search for just S100, you know, in the new, just like I did here, but in the new auctions, tons and tons of S100 boards. I mean, so lots of boards out there.
So you could build your own S100 system as long as you have the backplane.
And you know, you can still pick up, you could pick yourself up an S100 system and make it work and have a cool old, you know, mid to late 70s machine if you go generic.
Did you see this MSI PCS 80 S100 with the built-in screen?
That is it a live auction?
Yes,
I think it's been there. It's been there for a while, I think. Let me get rid of it. And I think it's from the one seller where...
The one I was talking about earlier.
Which, and we can talk about it. It's Vintage Computer Museum. Yep. It's the seller. And which we did contact this seller because we actually wanted to try to see if he or she would be on the show. And we just featured his or her auctions and spoke to them. I think that would be interesting, but they never responded. So, and they're in East Aurora, New York. But like, okay, so that one's not sold. That's a pretty interesting machine, though. That's pretty neat. I have to say, that's the first one I've ever seen.
I only see raster on the screen. I don't see output.
Yeah. But pretty neat. How do you like that deep blue and that MSI? It's pretty nice.
Yes. Before IBM took over that blue color.
And I don't know where this person got all this stuff, but man, they have a ton. You know, if you got the money, and because they definitely get premium prices. But you know what? On the other hand, everything's cleaned up and working. Well,
a lot of it is. Yeah, that's the good thing about it is that I don't think you'll buy anything dirty from that place. And
this person has a niche. All right.
It's like somebody who sells only sports cars. They might have two or three sports cars out in their front lot, but if they sell one, they can eat for 2 months.
So, Jeff, we got some email, some feedback.
Yes, we did.
Going to wrap the show up. Go ahead.
Joaquin Cruz gave us two thumbs up on our episode,
our interview.
Evan Koblenz. And here's somebody who says that they wish VCF Southwest was still viable. So there's a hint to the Federation. Mm-hmm. I may want to look into that. There's some people interested. And he was also glad that we mentioned Makerspace Movement. And it's something that's kind of on the fringe of what, you know, you and I do with this podcast, David. But it's still a similar mindset. You know,
right.
Try to do something good with something old and then come up with some new ideas for things. Old ideas, make them new. That's kind of what the Makerspace Movement is. Makerspace moves with making new things where we try to make old things work.
Well, but the key thing there is the parallel between the modern maker movement. And so, you know, they're electronic hobbyists and they're hackers in the sense of the really old term, the good way of being a hacker, you know, hacking something to work or hacking things to work together and so on.
The same people that would have the mindset to make those Pi PDP.
Yeah.
You know, thing
these are the same type of people that, you know, 40 years ago were, you know, trying to come up with we're computer hobbyists, the earliest computer hobbyists, you know, building Altairs and other things like that, or trying to build their own machines because they wanted one so badly.
Yeah, or making space people. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, or making things to, you know, their own upgrades for their own computers and stuff like that.
It's the makerspace people that would actually go and try to make a mini Atari 800 running in, you know, with working keys and emulated on a Raspberry Pi that you plug into your TV.
Yeah.
And it would also be the same people that make those portable, you know, Atari gaming systems and stuff. That's all makerspace type stuff. And even that, what was it, that Commodore joystick that Jerry Ellsworth made. Mm-hmm. You know, that's perfect makerspace. And she was one of the early birds in the makerspace movement, and that's a good example of makerspace meets vintage computing.
Yeah. Well, and she was recreating, she made also like a board, it was called the Commodore One, I think. So basically that was she was like remaking a Commodore, I guess, that became the joystick.
Well, she was remaking a board. She was remaking an environment that when you plug in a hardware module, it becomes either a Commodore 64 or a Commodore 128 or an Amiga.
Yeah.
That's my understanding of it, is that it was configurable through hardware. It would change its personality, but the board would provide common interface and I.O.
So what did what's this, Scott from Bellingham?
Scott from Bellingham. I guess in a previous episode, and I believe I may have mentioned the Opera web browser or something like that, how it's old, or somebody mentioned it and saying it was old.
Oh, yeah.
And he's basically saying that Opera web browser is still going strong. And, yeah, I believe that. There's Opera web browser. It's still kind of a fringe browser, but it does have its benefits. But he was talking about how apparently Opera forked, or not forked, but changed after version, 12.17. That's the old Opera. And he calls it a totally different beast. And then the new one.
Like some people, it looks like, trying to create a new an Opera that was more like the original one, called Vivaldi. I'm trying to look it up here.
Yeah, I wonder if this is similar to like with Firefox. Firefox started out as what, Mozilla browser, then became Firefox, and now I think there's a movement to make Mozilla again.
Oh, well, check it out. Here's a here's an article from just 2 days ago at Network World, and I'll put it in the show notes, called "Opera Founder Talks Up New Vivaldi Browser." So here you go.
All right. This is good information. Where was I? I'm like clicking through here. Let me close some of these windows. I got so many eBay windows open. Can't even find the document anymore. But this is good information. I'm glad he brought this up. I would have thought Opera was just, you know, dead in the water otherwise, and maybe some of our listeners would have believed that too. So this is good information. I have to look into this Vivaldi, find out some of the features. I guess people like the older Opera because it was great from a, I wouldn't say from a hacking perspective, but maybe from a power user perspective. And Opera wanted to continue on and make a lighter version of their browser for the general surfer. You know, most average people don't need anything other than something that can show them the web page.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, play Flash. But Opera did have some power, and I guess this Vivaldi thing is bringing that power back to those who want to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But still be compatible with whatever growing standards are out there, HTML5, this, that, and the other.
So very interesting.
So we spread the word. I hope we spread it well enough.
Yeah, make sure to put that link in the show notes there.
Yes.
Right, add the Network World. What else did he say, though? Oh, and he's still trying to catch up on our podcasts and stuff, too.
It's keep nice listening, to have that Scott. Many out there that you have to catch up on it.
We're building a little portfolio. How many have we done now? This is show 9 just of the eBay series. So
yeah, and we have – and I still like plan on bringing the old one back.
We've done like, I don't know, pushing 30 maybe, something like that, 25.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about right.
Well, I'm starting to wake up fully, so I guess it's time to wrap up the show.
You ready to go now?
Well, got to go get breakfast done, too. So again, it's Sunday morning, listeners.
Oh, I did that already. I just didn't have my coffee.
Not me. I just got up in time to take a shower, go buy a coffee at McDonald's, and and finish show notes and get on. So normally, everyone, we record the show on Thursday evening so it can get posted on Fridays. Yeah, we try real hard to do. So
yeah, we're all worn out from the day anyway on Thursday.
So we should be able to get our next show, eBay Show 10, released properly on Friday, March 4th. And Anit will be continuing our 32-bit GUI discussion by covering The Next Computer by Steve Jobs.
Yes, if you didn't say it was by Steve Jobs, I think we have an Abbott and Costello routine here. The Next Computer. What's The Next Computer?
Right, right. You know, I saw a funny thing on Facebook where someone posted, they said it finally happened. And they showed a picture of a baseball player, and on the back of his shirt, his last name is capital H U, who?
So he's the first baseman.
And I guess, yeah, I guess it was a picture of him on first base. And it's like, who's up first? Yeah. So simply by mentioning the name Steve Jobs in this episode, we should, it's also a very rare episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
we should get lots more listeners.
Rare with at least three, at symbols in it.
You know, since we're doing eBay, they're eBay related episodes, we should always say they're very rare, very rare special episodes. So anyway, find all of our show notes at historyofpersonalcomputing.com. Send feedback to feedback@historyofpersonalcomputing.com because we really like to hear from you. You know, we do have a Facebook page too, so just do a search for History of Personal Computing on Facebook and join our Facebook group. Like us and all that good stuff, and you know, tweet us and everything else. And that's really it for today's show. So just remember, caveat emptor, which means let the buyer beware, and take care of those old computers, keep them clean and play with them once in a while, or find them a new home.
And also remember, our eBay episodes always have free delivery.
See you next time, Jeff.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Knick-knack, just check. A++. They all say they love me on eBay. Gonna buy a slightly damaged golf.